Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a mother's life change when her little girl becomes a woman? And what does it take to convert the patterns forged by years of caretaking and need into a fully adult relationship? When they took their first trip to Greece together in the late 1990s, my guests today were not only finding their way to a new kind of kinship, but also struggling with the life changes they were experiencing individually. The mother's passage from youth into middle age, the newly fledged adulthood of the daughter after graduation from college. Ultimately, their journeys were both separate and shared, and they are here now to talk about the process. Sue Monk-Kidd is a writer whose works include The Secret Life of Bees, The Mermaid Chair, and The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. Her daughter, Anne Kidd Taylor, is also a writer. The new memoir they have written together is called Traveling with Pomegranates, a mother-daughter story. They're in town for tonight's Arts and Letters Live event at the First Presbyterian Church of Dallas. Anne, Sue, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sue, you write at the beginning of the book, I want my daughter back. And it wasn't as if you'd had some terrible falling out. But maybe you can talk about what you were feeling as you got the idea of planning this trip for your 50th birthday and for your daughter's graduation.
Well, I got this very lavish idea that we would go off to Greece together to mark those milestones of turning 50 and graduating from college, which coincided the same summer. I really wasn't thinking at the time about this mother-daughter world and our relationship at all. But when we got over there, within 24 hours, we're standing in front of this Demeter and Persephone relief in the museum. And this is the oldest mother-daughter story in the world, practically. And as we were standing there, I began to realize that this trip, surreptitiously, was about trying to reconnect with my daughter.
Mm-hmm. And you had really fallen in love with Greece on a school trip that you'd taken a year and a half before. This return, though, sort of unbeknownst to your mom, felt to you like it was going to be a very different experience.
It did. When we set out, I was withholding a little information from my mom, which was I was hoping that I was going to go back to Greece and find that same spirit and that same fire, and I would know once again what I was going to do with my life because my plan had kind of collapsed. So, yes, we went under this veil of celebration, but I was secretly hoping for something, that something else would happen for me.
Well, and it's really interesting the dynamic that you both write about, because there is that sense that you're not quite sure what to do with your own feelings, and then you also don't know how they'll be, I suppose, perceived by the other person. And so for a while, you're both sort of keeping things close to the vest, even though you have a close relationship.
Well, that's the curious thing about it. I think that Anne and I had drifted apart in a way, and it seemed like a natural course that happened when she went to college. And, you know, silence, we weren't talking as much, there wasn't as much communication. And I realized we were really at a crossroads. And I do think mother-daughter relationships come to these kind of natural crossroads where the whole relationships more or less has to be reinvented, renegotiated, rediscovered somehow, because you have to shift into a whole new conversation as mother and daughter. And we had definitely come to one of those moments, and it sort of creeps up on you, the ways that you begin to lose one another.
Well, that creep is interesting, because you write that initially you sort of assumed that you had somehow passed that phenomenon by of the empty nest. You weren't grieving when your kids left home. You were like, this is great, I've got all this freedom. And so it shocked you that in fact it manifested itself in maybe a slightly different way.
Absolutely shocked me. I thought I was above that and beyond that, you know. But the truth is, we often very glibly say, I mean, myself included, a lot of my friends were always saying, oh, the kids are gone, great, now we can start this life, you know, that we perhaps didn't have enough time for or whatever. But I think in that glibness about Anne leaving, oh, it's really kind of wonderful, the empty nest and the new freedom, I think beneath that there was a sort of small lament, you know, a kind of grieving that I wasn't completely aware of. What does it mean when that last child leaves, or that any child leaves? And especially that daughter who feels like an appendage of your own self. I mean, there it's a very profound experience, actually. And I felt like it needed to be, or I was sort of surprised that it needed to be negotiated, rethought, and dealt with.
On the other hand, from your perspective, Anne, there's a parallel experience, I suppose, when you finally are out on your own as a young adult. But I don't know how much looking back is typical. You know, usually you don't think, I wish I was being taken care of by my parents. You think, look at me, look at everything I've done. But your realization was that it wasn't quite as easy to sort of be out there on your own as you had imagined.
Yes. I think it's easy a lot of times to think, oh, I'm in my early 20s. This is the best time of my life. I'm carefree. I don't have a care in the world. And so much of that is true because later other things set in, marriage, family, jobs, real world, mortgages, all of this stuff. But when you're just setting out, you know, all that is true. There's a certain carefree attitude. But you're also coming up against the bigger questions in life. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Who am I going to be? Who am I? How do I navigate this, my newfound independence out here in the world? And I floundered a little bit with that. And of course, I'd had this really big rejection from graduate school and did not know what I was going to do. So I felt very lost, you know, very lost. And so it was particularly hard for me at that time.
And one of the things you tried to do with your parents and with other people who cared about you was say, well, I don't care. It's totally fine. What I want to do is something else anyway. At the time, were you in a process of unpacking why you couldn't say, yeah, I'm devastated. I'll get over it, but I'm devastated.
It was so hard for me to admit to myself how devastating it was to get that letter at the time. And I think it made me feel uncomfortable. It made me feel like I wasn't the brightest girl in the world. And I thought, there's something really wrong with me. I'm not as smart as I thought. I'm not as capable. Maybe these people are onto something about me and they're letting me know. So it seemed like, you know, eventually this letter became a catch-all for everything that seemed wrong with me. And I don't know why at the time I actually kept this letter, but I kept this letter. But just couldn't admit to myself why. I think it felt uncomfortable, and I didn't want to face all that. So I thought, it's okay. I'm going to find something else to do. It's okay. And of course, that didn't work for me very well. And I really wanted to, I didn't want to, but I found myself needing to on that first trip to Greece, needing to confront all of that and say, maybe it's not such a good idea to run from this. And I think the thing that helped me see that was I saw something of my experience in the framework of that myth of Demeter and Persephone, of loss and search and return. And I really honed in on the return part. I thought, maybe it won't be this bad forever. I can come back, you know?
It's really interesting to me, too, that you talked about that myth, and clearly that explains the pomegranates for people who don't remember the myth, by the way. Maybe you can remind us of the story, and then I'll follow up with a question.
Well, it's about a mother who's getting a little older, and her daughter is coming into her young womanhood. Excuse me. Sorry. And Anne is very Persephone-like at that moment because she goes missing in this way, and her mother mounts this passionate search for Persephone, Demeter. So it is a story, as Anne said, about all the ways that mothers and daughters lose one another, and it's about the ways that mothers have to search for their daughters to refine them in new relationships and start new conversations. But the pomegranate is a kind of wonderful part of the story where Persephone bites into this pomegranate, eats the seeds in the underworld when she goes missing. And she's kind of – it's one of those necessary losses, really, that mothers and daughters face. And eating those seeds guarantees that she cannot return all the time to her mother. She has to remain in the underworld part of the year, which kind of symbolizes that separateness, that separate identity. But pomegranates are also very fertile symbols. Mm-hmm. And I latched onto that in my 50s, searching for new creativity, new life, and, you know, fulfilling some part of myself as I got older. So that fertility of the pomegranate was certainly an important part of it for me. But it figures into the story that Anne and I have. It figures into the Demeter Persephone myth. We're traveling with them. We're eating them. We're bumping into them in all kinds of ways throughout this trip. We're even wearing them on necklaces. So it's a big part.
Well, and it's really poignant when you talk about that sort of fertility. You know, you're dealing with, at the age of 50, you know, the onset of menopause and the idea that you're still fully a woman, but not fertile and not bearing children, just at the moment that your daughter is blossoming into the person who will do all these things that you're having to sort of step back from. Was there any part of you that envied her youth?
I can't say that it was really envy. I think that is something that often crops up at this intersection. And that was really the poignancy of the whole thing, was that what was happening to me, crossing this threshold into older womanhood, was occurring at the same moment that Anne was moving into young womanhood. And that stirs up a lot of things in both of us, I think. But, you know, there's the classic feeling of somehow passing the baton on or something. It's just sort of wired in us, perhaps, that way. So I think you have to come to terms with your own feelings about that.
And ultimately, the book plays out over about 2 years, and you take several different trips together. During this time, though, Anne, you were deciding what you really wanted to do with your life. And your mother is a writer. She's established. This is her thing. And it's something that you've done since you were a child, but you also have to negotiate the point at which you really need to fully break and be an entirely different person, and then this pull that you feel to do the thing that maybe you were born to do.
Yeah, so much of the story in the book is about me figuring this out and navigating that. And for the longest time, I wondered about, can my mom be a writer and me be a writer too? And what does that look like? And people are going to compare us, or people are going to say, the apple fell way, way, way far from the tree on that one. And then there was this whole practical side of that I had to think. I think at the time I was 23, and you know, who says I need a real stability and steady income? I'll be a writer. So there was some of that I had to consider, but ultimately I really came to learn or find in myself that I could not see myself, imagine myself breathing and not writing. So I had to make my peace with, a lot of it, and just do the thing, you know, give my heart over to this. And that's what I guess I was able to do.
Was there a part of you, Sue, that recognized Anne as a writer long before she saw it in herself?
I think so. You know, growing up, she was always going around writing the neighborhood newspaper. You know, I can remember some of those incredible headlines. You know, dog eats wiring out of dollhouse. I remember that one. And, you know, she had this almost natural, organic desire to be a writer. So I recognized that in her. It looked real familiar to my own experience.
Sue Monk Kidd and Anne Kidd Taylor are my guests. They are mother and daughter and authors of the new memoir, Traveling with Pomegranates, A Mother-Daughter Story. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are author Sue Monk Kidd and Ann Kidd Taylor. Their new book is called Traveling with Pomegranates, A Mother-Daughter Story. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we've talked about the Demeter Persephone story. You also sort of went to Greece, each somewhat fixated on a female spiritual figure, and you were really interested in the idea of Athena. And so you still had in your mind sort of what to do with the Virgin Mary. And what's so fascinating about both of these characters and the way you both approach them is that both of them in our mythology, in our sort of spirituality, tend to get pigeonholed into only one facet of who you ultimately saw them to be. Can you all talk about that?
Well, yes. I think one of the surprises of the trip, other than that it became this whole mother-daughter journey, was that I was captivated by the Virgin Mary. But particularly in a certain guise as the Black Madonna, these beautiful dark-skinned Madonnas that are all over Europe. I didn't know anything about them. Some of them are just coal black, and they're gorgeous, and they have a real presence and dignity and authority and power in their iconography. So I was really, I think my whole imagination was captured by the meaning of that. So, yes, I began to want to visit them. Study, write, and then, you know, the Black Madonna got herself a starring role in my novel, The Secret Life of Bees. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she had a real impact on me.
And do you want to talk a little bit about Athena and what appealed to you about her?
Yeah, she became incredibly important to me, especially on that very first trip I made when I was in college, is when I first latched on to her. She is about independence and selfhood, autonomy. And she's this warrior goddess and this goddess of wisdom. But in her earliest incarnation, she was this goddess of creativity. And so she was all of these things for me. And it's like you said, sometimes you can get one idea. You look up the description in Edith Hamilton's mythology, and then that becomes what she is. But I really looked at her whole history and loved all of that about her and seemed to gravitate toward those characteristics that I really needed to find in myself. So that is why she became so important to me. I needed to find a way to belong to myself and do that with some bravery. And you know, I bought a ring with her image on it, and that's just a small reminder. You know, it's easier said than done, but, you know, that's how she started to function in my life, I think.
You had dealt a lot, I know, with sort of shyness as a person. Did you feel like you needed to overcome that or needed to own that and recognize that that's just who you are?
Well, I think when I was in high school, I thought it was detrimental to be shy. Then I started to realize when I got to college, this is who I am, and I'm introverted. And I think the way I say it in the book is I'm introverted. So are a lot of normal people.
like your mom.
Like my mom. And so I think I had to learn to not only to accept that part of myself, but to accept myself, period. And the shyness, I find that there's nothing cures shyness more than having a child. so it's funny the ways that my child can pull me out of myself. But at the time when we're traveling, I think I was struggling with wanting to be out in the world and discover all of this and have this kind of natural inclination to be a little withdrawn. So I try to accept it and work with it too at the same time.
So you relate to that same kind of shyness or that introversion?
I am definitely introverted, which, as I explained to Anne, really means, because I looked this up, means that you seem to draw energy from inside of yourself rather than outside of yourself.
Which makes sense for a writer.
Yeah, exactly. Many, many writers are introverted. So they live in that interior place of ideas and how they're interacting and reflecting with all of that. Extroverted people draw energy from, you know, other people and outside of themselves. But, you know, I never really had the shy aspect that Anne had. But it's two different things, really. Anne said in the book, I thought it was a great line. She said, you know, I'm introverted and I'm shy on top of it. And you know how the world loves a shy introvert.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. My guests this hour are Sue Monk Kidd and Anne Kidd Taylor, whose book is called Traveling with Pomegranates, A Mother-Daughter Story. We have an email here from Paul in Terrell who says, I wonder if The Secret Life of Bees also has a little of the Persephone story, too, a daughter who goes missing into a secret life.
How perceptive.
Wow.
Absolutely. You know, when we were traveling in Greece, Turkey, we made actually three trips we write about in this book, then to France, then back to Greece. Throughout all of those travels, I was trying to conceive this notion of becoming a novelist. I was trying to crystallize that. I was 50 years old trying to find the courage to go into that brave new world of becoming a novelist. And I also had this idea for The Secret Life of Bees in my head. It was a little tiny seed, but it was there. So I was vacillating about that as well. But while I was traveling, I came to terms with this. And it was through the experiences we were having and the places we were visiting and things that were happening around me that began to clarify that. And I began to draw, as Anne says, some bravery to go and do that. But you can see that that myth of Demeter and Persephone was operating in the background all the time. I mean, Anne and I were very aware of it with our relationship, of the necessary losses that go on, the searching and the returning to one another in new ways. So those two things got blurred and connected. The writing of The Secret Life of Bees and the myth. So I was aware that my character, Lily, in The Secret Life of Bees was Persephone searching for Demeter. So the tables got turned a little bit. Mm. It wasn't the mother searching for the daughter. It was the daughter searching for the mother. But yes, indeed, it's there.
What made it feel like such a different sort of step to move into the realm of fiction as opposed to having sort of successfully written nonfiction at the back?
Yeah, very good question because I guess any kind of transition creatively takes a deep breath. You know, you have to kind of take a deep breath to go do it. I felt like there was safety in what I was doing. I had been doing it a long time. It was so familiar. But interestingly, I fell into a kind of creative vacuum at around 50. I found I couldn't write in the same way that I used to write the nonfiction. It was as if something had run its course and something new wanted to begin, which, in fact, in my opinion, is what some portal in turning 50 is all about. Something is ending and something new wants to start as an older woman. But creatively, it's certainly true. And anytime you come to that moment where you have to leap, make a little leap, new creative vision, a new voice, you're going to live out loud in a whole new way. I think it requires what feels like a lot of courage at the moment. Then you look back and think, why was that a big deal? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did. I had to go drum up the courage inside to do it.
And the thing that became this book actually started for you as a solo project. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I realized in 2000, so it's 9 years ago, I can't believe it. And one of those trips, our last trip to Greece, that I not only was I going wanted to be a writer, I wanted to write a book about all of these travels. So I came home and saw myself as an apprentice to the work. And I thought, well, that gives me 7 years to learn the craft of this, at least. But I set in writing about these experiences and came to realize that there was so much more going on. That if the trips were so transformative for me, and I knew they were for my mom, that her voice needed to be in there too. And then there was a whole third story, which was the story of our relationship. And I thought, well, that has to be told. So I called my mom in 2003 and asked her if she wanted to write this book with me. And she said yes, that she did. And it took some time for us to get to it. You know, there was a lot of things on her plate at the time. And I was pregnant with my son. But we did eventually get to the writing. It took about 3 years, I think, for us to write the book.
And talk about the process a little bit, what the rhythm was in terms of one of you would write a chapter and send it to the other. And is that how it went?
Pretty much. In the beginning, we did a lot of visioning together. We'd sit in my study usually. Anne lives about 15 minutes away from me, so we would gather and talk and get off the subject. And this is why it took 3 years.
We were, 3 good years,
you know,
I guess.
We were suddenly talking about what color fabric to put on the pillows in the living room. But I think that we had to talk our way through and map it out. And then we would go to our separate desk and write without really knowing what the other one was writing. But we had this overall kind of a vision and map to go by. Then we'd come sit down and hand each other our chapters with a little trepidation, I think, and see what one another had written. So that was the way it unfolded throughout the whole process. Of course, we'd go back and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite to try to hone it. It was a challenging book to write, actually. It took 3 years, I think, not because we had different visions. It turned out to be a pretty compatible, deepening experience for us to do this. I mean, challenging at times, but it was mostly because the structure of this book is layered. There, as Anne said, there's her story of entering young womanhood and all of the struggles that she was dealing with, these large questions. Then there's my story of trying to become an older woman from this deeper standpoint of the soul. What is that odyssey that the soul wants to make in a woman at 50 or 55? But then the story of Anne and I as a mother and daughter. So we were really trying to weave several stories and intersect them in alternating voices. So it was a demanding kind of process. But when it was over, we were pretty pleased that we told this authentic and honest story the best we could.
Did that trepidation that you each felt, and maybe the seed of that was different for each of you individually, I wonder how much of it had to do with thinking, not only am I revealing, you know, my writing and the way that I've chosen to phrase things to this person that whose opinion really matters to me, but I'm writing about her and me, mm-hmm. and things that I haven't fully decided where I am with them.
Yeah, some of it was, you're right, you hand over a chapter, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness! This could come back to me, scratched up, marked up, edited, or something. and I would joke with my mom, and I think I even say in the book, at least with my mom, if she's my reader, I can suggest a color pen. When you use red, I would say it just the pages are bleeding. You know?
She would not let me use red.
No.
So what color did you use?
Anything but red, blue, purple, anything. But some of it was that, because I was learning or having to learn a great deal just by doing it.
Sure.
This was so brand new for me. And then, of course, there's that other side you mentioned where I'm handing her a chapter and I'm revealing something to her that she knew of maybe at the time, but she was getting the whole picture now. So I felt very comfortable. I felt very... I think we have a very deep level of trust between us. And I think you have to feel, I can't imagine not feeling vulnerable handing her that, but I think we met each other with a lot of love and a lot of respect. So I guess there were a few surprises in the chapters coming back and forth, but it was, I think we worked very well together, I have to say. It was fun.
I'm remembering the first chapter that I handed to Anne, she looked at me and said, "Wow, I didn't know that you had a conflict between motherhood and writing when I was a toddler." And I described this pull in me toward my own separate life, to that book and that writing, and then this pull to these children. And so that tension was in me, unlike my mother, who seemed to never have any of that inner conflict about that.
She was happy at home.
Oh, yes. My mother was just, you know, this quintessential mother
and still is.
Yeah, exactly. And loved the domesticity of her home and being a homemaker. And, of course, then I had to go differentiate myself from her, as daughters have to do. Mm-hmm. But I did experience that. And I remember Anne being so surprised that I articulated that and expressed it the way I did in the chapter. And she said, "I didn't know that." I said, "Well, now you know that." Now I think, as a mother, she's beginning to understand what I was talking about.
Well, it strikes me that the other risk here is that, and I don't have grown children, but when you're raising children, the last thing you want to do as a mother is let them know that you're uncertain about anything,
exactly.
You know? And I guess to have a fully adult relationship, to relate to each other as women and not simply as the caretaker and the one who receives care, you have to let some of that go. Did that feel risky to you?
I don't think it really felt risky. Probably the fact that through our travels over the course of those 3 years, Anne and I did reach a new place. We were able to meet one another as two women with independent lives, very intimately and lovingly, and kind of re-find one another in a new way, which led to us being able to collaborate, I think, with a lot of honesty and you know, I tell her, "Well, I'm always your mom. I wouldn't change that for anything in the world." But I really love being her friend and a close woman friend. So that allowed us to be able to not be so surprised to talk about things. So this book, just the writing of it, opened up all kinds of places for us to talk and deepen our relationship.
My guests this hour are Sue Monk Kidd and Anne Kidd Taylor. They are mother and daughter and authors of the new memoir, Traveling with Pomegranates, a mother-daughter story. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Anne Kidd Taylor and Sue Monk Kidd. Their new book is called Traveling with Pomegranates, a mother-daughter story. They are in town for Arts and Letters Live that will take place tonight at the First Presbyterian Church of Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And I think what's interesting for you in this whole process is that you, as a young woman, are still sort of moving forward into that space that your mom occupied 11 years ago in the book. Do you think about that a lot, and have you sort of set that up as an expectation for how you might feel as your son grows up and you're sort of saying goodbye to him?
Hmm. Well, I think it is going to be different for mothers and sons. Wow, mother, you should write a book about that to give me some guidelines. But I think there's a difference there. Mm-hmm. And that I'll have to navigate that one. But I think, you know, when I look forward, the ways, it's interesting, you know, I used to look forward and see all the ways my mom has modeled, because she's, you know, she was my first model as a little girl. We look up and see what our moms are doing, and we check in and we see, oh, well, this is how something's going to play out. Usually it's because you're watching your mom do it. So for the longest time, I looked at my mother, and it was about what home looked like and then what career looked like. And then over the course of writing this book, I was able to look forward into what older womanhood looks like. So I can look at my mom and I can see what she's done and this kind of rich inner life that she has and this creativity that came at 50. And that's, I find that very inspiring for me. So, you know, not only, you know, did I see her model all these things in her life from me in her 30s, but older womanhood as well. You know, I think that's a big gift that she's given me.
I wonder when you read about her conflict, you know, with raising kids and being a devoted parent and also having this work life and the pull that they both exerted on her, reading this at the time that you were expecting your first child, when sort of that's the focus of everything in your world, was it initially hard for you to relate to that? Or did you instantly think, oh, God, what a relief, because I worry about that too?
First of all, like my mom said, I was surprised by it. I never saw that tension in her. And then to read that, I felt relieved that it was okay to be pulled toward my writing and this creativity and what I wanted to do, and also be pulled to this baby in the crib and feel torn between the two sometimes. You know, I found great relief in that. Oh, it's not just me. My mother felt this, and I never noticed. Well, that's, you know, I never saw that. You know, we would joke that, well, my grandmother was literally getting the Mother of the Year awards, and my mom was getting the Career Woman of the Year awards. And, you know, I'm thinking, why isn't my mom getting Mother of the Year? I think she's was always a fantastic mother when I was little. But I think, you know, my mom revealing that to me, that struggle, it was surprising. But then I think that's part of, you know, my mom speaks about older womanhood and how you have to see the ways to let your daughter go. And I think that crossing into younger womanhood, part of that is seeing all the ways your mom is more than your mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is this whole person with a whole realm of experiences and her own inner life, just like you have, you know. So some of it is seeing your mom outside of that role. And I was beginning to do that, you know, at the time.
Did you see part of that letting her go, Sue, as saying the thing that you're not supposed to say to your kids, which is that sometimes I'd rather be at work than watching you, and vice versa?
Mm. No, I think, I think you have to hide that well when they're small. But the trip gave us lots of moments for revelations mm-hmm. with one another. And Anne, as she said, was withholding a lot of things about her own depression and devastation about graduate school, disappointments, a lot of things in her life falling apart at that moment. And I was, my antenna was up. I knew something was going on, but she wasn't communicating that to me. So it was, you know, that became a revelation. My opening up to her about the pulls and tensions in my own life, the conflict between, as I called it, Booker baby. What was it going to be? But other things too, the pull to work and have a voice in the world, or the pull to just be and let that be enough. So there were lots of moments of revelation happening that began to create this new way of communicating and being together that redefined the relationship. I think there were just so many of those that happened over the course of the 3 years that it wasn't just that one moment of having to let go. There was a lot of necessary loss, but there was also so much fun and humor and, moments when we, on the trips that we write about, when we just would kind of lose it. It was something funny happening and we would be like two giggling girls or something. So,
was it cats that you fed in a restaurant or
right.
some stray animals?
You know, it was after we had finished the book that I turned to Anne and I said, are you aware that I wrote about this encounter we had with cats in Greece in the Plaka, which turned into this sort of Keystone Cop fiasco thing that happened where, you know, we fed a few cats and suddenly there were about 50 or 60 cats around the table and just taking over the cafe. And it was an eruption of all of this from the waiters. And we had to slink out pretty much.
Threw your cash on the table.
That's right. I was like, check, please. And then Anne wrote about a moment in France on another trip that had to do with dogs that was kind of funny. And I said, you know, we didn't realize that until later, where we went into a restaurant in this quaint little village in the middle of France. And I ordered, you know, French. And Anne, in a moment of misguided nostalgia, I guess, ordered a hamburger, which came in a little plastic bag, microwave that was the size of a biscuit that she later fed to all the French dogs who were gathered there. And we, as she said, oh, they're so excited. They're thinking another American tourist ordered the hamburger.
Were there things that in early drafts either one of you wrote about that taking a second look at, you stopped and said, you know what, that's too personal. That's for us, and that doesn't need to be in the book.
I don't know if that happened, but I think we were always checking in along the way of writing this. Are we being truthful? Are we being authentic? And that was always the goal. And I think the minute something started to feel like it too revealing, or just, you know, as my husband told me, Anne, it's like you, it's not crude, but it was pretty frank. It's like you cut your chest open and poured your guts out. Mm-hmm. and I think that we want it to be revealing and authentic, but I didn't want to cross some line. And I think that, you know, where I'm writing about a relationship with an ex-boyfriend at the beginning of the book, I certainly didn't want to get into territory there where I was really characterizing him. I really wanted to focus on my response to that relationship ending because, and even, you know, this little Greek romance that's in the book, those relationships with those two people are over and they're not in my life. And I felt I needed to treat that respectfully and honestly. So I think in those particular cases, if I felt that I might be saying too much or if I got uncomfortable, I would just check in with myself and say, tell the truth about this. But, you know, if I start to get a little wary, I might pull back. But ultimately, I feel very good about what is in the book and my story.
Well, I think there was nothing really, as far as our relationship goes, that we could say we took out. I'm pretty sure of that. In fact, I think we were mostly saying to one another, you know, you need to push further with that. Mm-hmm. We challenged one another all the time to write this with a great deal of honesty. So there's nothing that is conspicuously not there for sure. I think there's a wonderful quote that I wish I could say exactly right, which is an Anais Nin quote, the poet. And I put that quote on my desk while we were writing Traveling with Pomegranates, and Anne did as well. And it really challenges the writer to not – it says, in fact, that the role of the writer is not to say what we can all say. It is to say what we cannot say. And so that was what we kept trying to do. Was to say that unspoken thing that was there about the mother-daughter relationship, our own. And, you know, there's a lot of brutal honesty in the book, actually.
I know you both have to be aware of how fortunate you are to have the relationship that you have and that not everyone has that. Do you both believe, though, at the heart of things that every mother and daughter in the perfect circumstances want to know each other as much and as deeply as you know each other as adults? Or do you think there are families in which everybody sort of decides to leave well enough alone?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, this is a memoir and it is our story. What you hope is that in articulating the truth of your own experience, that it will resonate with other people's experience and cause them to look at their own story, but they're all different. I think there is some universality in the story we write in the sense of it being in that mythic vein of Demeter and Persephone, that every relationship between mothers and daughters has some loss, it has some search and return, but it all looks different in the particulars of our lives. But yeah, I mean, I think we all make our choices about how we'll do that, but probing a little deeper sometimes has great riches, even though initially it can be a little uncomfortable.
Do you think, and you mentioned that you think it may be different, you know, raising a son, but are there things that you're sort of hoping to tell your son someday about your life? Are you sort of journaling or keeping something that you'll want to present him with?
Yes. In fact, before he was born, my mom gave me a baby book, you know, for him. And one of the things in there was write your unborn baby a letter. And so I sat down. I was, you know, 9 months pregnant, very uncomfortable. And I sat down at my kitchen table and I wrote him a letter. And I told him how really I tried to distill down what I had learned from, I guess, these trips. And really that the world is out there and it is large, and to step into it and see how beautiful it is. And of course, there's another side to that I didn't, you know, put in the letter, but really step into this world, that it is out there and you should see it and you should embrace it and you should embrace yourself in it. And that I had gone on these trips with his grandma, and one day I wanted to take him to Greece to see these things. And I think I do. I really want to instill in him a sense of wonder about this world and how it can open up those some of those same questions I ask myself, but also that on the flip side, that home, you know, being away from home and doing all of that stuff and traveling is fantastic, but being at home is just as wonderful, and you can have all of those lessons and be at home, and I want to instill that in him as well.
Did you write a letter to your grandson?
Not yet. That gives me a, she's inspired me. I may have to come home, and I have three grandchildren,
oh.
So
mm-hmm.
I may have to write one to each one of them.
Are there still things, mistakes that you want to get in the way of, and things that you want to do to sort of body block your 33-year-old daughter from making?
Of course. What the protective instinct in a mother never goes away, I'm sure. You know, when Anne said she wanted to be a writer, you know, I didn't encourage it and I didn't discourage it. I was sort of just over there on the sidelines. I thought, well, if I push her into that, even though I see her capacity for that, it's going to look like I'm trying to drag her into the family business or something. So I won't do that. But you know, she came to it on her own, but there were a lot of ways I wanted to protect her as she set out to be a writer. You know, I wanted to keep her from falling into the same problems I had, feeling rejected, you know, a lot of things a mother wants to do to help her daughter. That'll never change.
Sue Monk Kidd and Ann Kidd Taylor will appear tonight at Arts and Letters Live, taking place at the First Presbyterian Church in Dallas. You can learn more about that appearance at dallasmuseumofart.org. The book is called Traveling with Pomegranates, A Mother-Daughter Story. It's been a real pleasure to have you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.